from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll get a preview of an exhibit about spirits at the State Museum, and we are not talking ghosts.
Oh, fun. I'll find out about the new season of the Guitar Society of Indianapolis.
And I'll take a look at IRT's upcoming season as seen through the paintings of Kyle Ragsdale. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. The era of flappers, suffragists, bootleggers, and temperance lobbyists, plus real-life legends like Al Capone, will come to life in the exhibit American Spirits, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition at the Indiana State Museum. Travis DiNicola spoke with Susanna Kerber, Rebecca Smith, and Carrie Miller from the State Museum.
Carrie, Susanna, Rebecca, welcome to Art of the Matter. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you for
having
us.
Thank you.
Absolutely. So, this sounds like a really fun exhibit. I've been curious about it ever since I first heard there was something dealing with spirits at the State Museum. Certainly there's more to it than just that, and there's a lot of history. Susanna, let's start with you and tell me a bit about the background of the American Spirits exhibit.
Sure. Well, the exhibition, which was organized by the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia, is about the rise and fall of prohibition. In fact, it's the first comprehensive
exhibition.
So it's
not just about booze.
No, but there's a lot of booze in
it. Okay, good,
good.
Just checking. Okay.
And all the people who are fighting for and against, which itself is a really fascinating story. The coalitions that came together to pass prohibition, and then all of the things that went awry before it was ultimately repealed about 14 years after it went into place, really makes for interesting story. And it's not just a story about drinking. It's also a story about women's suffrage, the passage of the income tax, the rise of national syndicates in organized crime and of law enforcement to try to combat them, the whole debate around individual rights, changes in social mores. And it involves so many stories that it really makes for a fascinating and fun exhibition. And there are all the flappers and
culture, too. Fashion and music and literature. I mean, that's all
right.
Part of that time period as well.
It is. And there's jazz music. There are the flappers that you would expect. Al Capone's in it, Carrie Nation, all of the figures that you would be looking for. But it's also very much the broader story that shows just all of the cultural trends that culminated in Prohibition, as well as the changes that we're still living with today.
So it sounds like a really cool exhibit. So this is a traveling exhibit that the State Museum has chosen to bring here. But obviously you're going to be putting your own twist on things with this. Let's talk a little bit about that. Carrie, let's start with you as far as how is the State Museum interpreting this and what sort of programs going along with it?
Oh, we have a variety of programs. They range from anywhere from talking about the rise of craft beer in Indiana, Hoosier Blue Laws, and we even have a special opening night, one night only party at the museum where we're transforming the museum into a speakeasy. There will be theater performances throughout the run of the exhibition as well. And when you come and visit the museum, you might be lucky enough to have a one-on-one encounter with one of the characters from that time.
Wow. Theater performances? Let's go back to that one. What sort of performances for that, Rebecca?
Sure. It's more of a radio show, so we're going to be hosting
I like radio shows.
Yeah. You're going to be able to take part in a 1920s radio show, so it'll be live in front of the audience. But you will get to hear some music from that period that was maybe created by Indiana people, like Cole Porter, for example. So that's just one of the, like Carrie noted, a lot of different kinds of programs that are going to be happening to coincide with this exhibition. So another program that she mentioned is actually going to be happening on September 20th from noon until 4. That's our big opening day. So you
That sounds like that's going to be a great party.
It's going to be great. That's more of a family-friendly party, so that will get the visitor acquainted with the exhibition, but then we'll have all different kinds of activities going on throughout the museum. We are working with Naptown Stomp to teach our visitors how to do the Charleston.
Very cool.
We're working with Jaden Street Jazz. They're going to be playing some music popular from the time. And then, as Carrie noted, you might have an encounter or two with people like Billy Sunday, who was an evangelist from Winona Lake, Indiana. Suffragettes from, we're going to be working with the Proplium Historic Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
So,
awesome.
Be prepared, but it'll be fun too. We'll be doing a lot of popular culture activities like slang and, like I said, dancing and music.
So let me ask the three of you, because without dwelling on this too much, but I mean, the title is American Spirits, and certainly no matter sort of how you interpret it, the prohibition of alcohol is the key of all of this. But yet I'm sure there must have been some concern amongst the staff at the museum as far as how do we put on an exhibit about alcohol without necessarily celebrating alcohol in an inappropriate way.
Sure. Well, and part of it is the exhibition deals with the really earnest debates that were going on and says there was a fundamental problem with alcohol in the country that really started this. And in 1830, the American population per capita drank the equivalent of 90 bottles of 80 proof liquor every year.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
I mean, that's a significant amount.
That is. So you can see what started prohibition. And while that gradually declined, it's still, even though distilled spirits went down, then beer increased about eightfold by the end of the
now,
this
part
century.
Of this.
So all of that is really tracked how people were trying to deal with the social factors and results of that level of drinking.
And part of it, though, I mean, historically, it was, I mean, essentially drinking distilled spirits was somewhat safer than, I mean, there weren't necessarily soft drinks. Water was somewhat questionable. Juices were not necessarily being preserved. I mean, there were limitations, too.
Certainly. Right? Clean water was a big issue. Mm-hmm. And you know, your cider held up better if it was maybe at least 10% alcohol or so. I mean, there were definitely factors. But there were also issues. Like, for example, the women's suffrage movement very quickly was tied in with it because women had no real power. They couldn't vote. They couldn't own property. They couldn't divorce their husbands. So if their husbands were drinking away all of the family resources, they didn't have any recourse. And so suffrage and prohibition become very intimately tied together throughout this entire process. Then when you get into the actual prohibition period, you're right, a lot of the stories we associate with it are glamorous. But when you look at all of the negative effects, you know, we really don't shy away from those. And those were everything from poisonings due to wood alcohol to the violence of organized crime, to just the institutionalized hypocrisy that came into play, a lot of corruption. So it's not all glamour. And then on the more subtle side, for example, there is a speakeasy. It's a very interactive, very fun exhibition. There is a speakeasy, no alcohol served. In that, you can sit at tables, you can learn the slang, you can learn about the cocktails, dance the Charleston, listen to jazz music. But I was talking to one of the exhibition developers, and if you actually tried some of the cocktails, they would probably put you off drinking forever.
Oh. So. Well, you know, I mean, that's an interesting thing because, I mean, of course, during Prohibition, a lot of, you know, whether it was bathtub gin or whatever people were making, some of it was so undrinkable that, in fact, so many of the cocktails that we know today sort of began at that time because people were trying to find something to mix it with to make it acceptable.
Exactly.
To drink.
Exactly. And as you said, soft drinks really rise. And Coca-Cola consumption triples during Prohibition. And a lot of that was to replace drinking. Drinking dropped about 70% in the first years of Prohibition, started going back up, probably ended up about 30% down from it what it had been beforehand. But again, some of that alcohol was so bad that if you didn't drink Coca-Cola instead, you probably drank it with just to disguise some of the taste of often what was industrial alcohol that was just reworked to be drinkable.
So ladies, may I ask you, as you've been all working on the show and learning about this, what's one thing that really stands out for each of you that was just like, wow, I never knew that or thought that? Or maybe something that in terms of the programming you're working on that you're like, oh, I'm so excited about. We'll start with you, Carrie.
I'm very excited about the program in October titled The Rise of Craft Beer in Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
I am seeing so many of the breweries popping up, not just in Indianapolis, but also where I live down in Johnson County. And I've just been reading how the growth of that has just been popping up exponentially.
Yeah,
and I want to learn more.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to read, you know, is it sustainable, the number that's going up? Are we going to be able to carry that? And what goes on behind the scenes? How each brewery is different. I just want to pick some people's brains at our talk there in October and learn more myself.
Very good. Rebecca, how about you?
Oh, a couple of things.
Yeah.
One is we are hosting a program called, we're calling Hoosier Blues, a look at Indiana's blue liquor laws. And that's in January. And as you know, and any Hoosier will know, we've had an interesting time in our history with blue laws and Sunday sales of liquor laws. So that is a program that is going to explain that to people like me, to people who are interested.
Sure.
The other thing is, like I mentioned before, I'm really excited about opening day. And just because we're hosting a couple of parties, just to make you aware, September 20th is the family day.
Mm-hmm.
October 3rd is the adult party.
Good to know.
So plan accordingly.
Okay, we won't mix those two up. Susanna, how about you?
Well, I think something people might find eye-opening in the exhibition is an interactive quiz that asks you which side you would be on. Mm-hmm. And there were so many disparate groups that were for or against. I mean, on the dry or anti-alcohol side, you had certainly people who had strong religious faith. You had the suffragists. You had progressives who thought the government could better society. You had populists. You had nativists. You had the Klan. Quite the mix. Hmm. They wouldn't have all gotten along well in the same room. And on the wet side, against people who had economic interests, people who had political interests, immigrants for whom it was part of their culture. And when you take this quiz, you might be surprised where you land.
Interesting. I'll be sure to check that out when I'm there. Well, I raise a glass to all of you, and thank you so much for coming into Art of the Matter today to talk about this great exhibit coming up at the State Museum.
Thank you, Travis.
Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with Susanna Kerber, Rebecca Smith, and Carrie Miller from the State Museum. The exhibit American Spirits, The Rise and Fall of Prohibition opens September 20th with a celebration of the 20s from noon to 4 p.m. with dancing, but no drinking. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
Classical guitar fans can enjoy regular concerts by some of today's leading performers, thanks to the Society of the Classical Guitar. Sharon Gamble invited classical guitarist and organizer John Alvarado to tell us more.
So how many years is this for the Indiana Society of the Classical Guitar? I know it's been around a little bit.
Yeah. The Society for the Classical Guitar began in 2006. So we've been around for a while. I've been president since 2009.
Congratulations, and I'm sorry.
They tell me I'm president for life, actually. Now,
so were you one of the founders?
I was, yes, of this version of it. Apparently, this did exist several years back in the 70s, I think. But for whatever reason, as these things do, they kind of went defunct. But shortly after I moved back here in 2004 and began meeting with classical guitarists here in town, one of the things that we kept discussing was that there was a great classical music culture here in Indianapolis,
right,
with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra and the Chamber Orchestra and all that, but that guitar was not really part of that for whatever reason, that there was a great history of blues and country and rock here in Indianapolis, but that the classical guitar was not really part of Indianapolis's musical scene, even though there were great programs. There was Butler's classical guitar program, there was University of Indianapolis, IUPUI, and so I had come from Chicago and from Phoenix, where there were really great classical guitar series going, and I just assumed that that happened everywhere. And when I moved here, I was really disappointed that that opportunity didn't exist. So I worked with a lot of the other people working in the classical guitar community here to try to really build a community of classical guitarists here in Indianapolis.
But the organization is statewide, is that right?
No, we're not actually statewide. We're the Indianapolis Society of the Classical Guitar.
Got it.
There is a society down in Bloomington, and there's a society down in Evansville.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And so one of the things that we wanted really was to get something going on here because this is the capital city.
Yeah, of course. Do you have have you done some kind of census? You have an estimate of how many classical guitar performers there might be in Indianapolis alone?
I don't have a specific number on that, but I know that we've got quite a few coming up because of the programs at Butler University and IUPUI, our program there, and one down at UND. So there's a pretty lively group of classical guitarists around here that are working, and students as well as professionals.
Sure. I want you to put on your hat not only as a performer of classical guitar, but also as a teacher. You've been at IUPUI for how long?
Since 2007.
How do you think most people come to classical guitar? Do they start with some other music genre and then discover the classical repertoire and move over?
I think that's probably it, yeah. I think most guitarists in the United States start as popular music instrumentalists. That's what I did. I started playing rock music and popular music when I first began. And I think a lot just kind of come to find classical guitar for a lot of reasons. For me, it was looking at conservatories, looking at going to school to study music and finding that you had to audition either as jazz or classical. And so that was when I was first introduced really to the idea of classical, when I was first looking into that. And I think for a lot of guitarists, they're really drawn to the idea that in most contexts as a guitarist, you're part of a whole. You're either the rhythm section or you're playing lead guitar over a band. But classical guitar is very much like classical concert piano in that it's all self-contained, the bass lines, the melodies, the inner voices. And so for a lot of guitarists, they're really drawn to that ability to really be a self-contained instrumentalist and really do it all at once. And it's really appealing to a lot of guitar players once they find it.
So talk to me about the technique implications for somebody who's been playing pop or rock.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to... And do some of your students have to unlearn some technique?
they certainly do. Yeah, yeah, they do. Probably the biggest issue is that unlike a lot of what popular music guitar players do and rock players, where they use a pick to either strum or play individual lines, because of the fact when you're playing classical, you're doing multiple parts simultaneously, it's all done finger style in the right hand. So you may have the thumb playing an independent bass line, maybe on the top strings, a finger playing an independent melody, and then also handling inner voices. So everything's moving simultaneously with contrasting rhythms. So they need to use the right hand a little bit more independently than a pick, which can only do one thing at a time, obviously. So that's probably one of the biggest changes for a lot of students coming into this style. Left-hand technique, too, there is the independence of the voices as opposed to the kind of block movement of chords that they're used to doing.
It's like a whole other instrument you're describing.
In a lot of ways it really is. It's kind of like a whole other beast. It's tuned the same, it looks the same, but the approach is very, very different and challenging but exciting for people who really choose to adopt that.
So you have a classical guitar score in front of you and you're learning something that has melody, harmony, inner voices, outer voices. Do you tackle that? This may sound like an odd question, but do you tackle that one measure at a time with all of the notes, or do you go through and figure out, okay, this is the melody and here's what fingers need to do that throughout the entire piece?
I think it's both. I think what I tell my students all the time is when it comes to practicing, they have to have a lot of tools in their toolbox. And different pieces will require them approaching them in different ways. And it'll just kind of require different kinds of thinking. So it's important that they be able to isolate those lines and understand what's going on, but also that they be able to kind of take it up in as a whole, as a group. So I think it has to be both as they're studying it. A performer needs to be able to understand the piece from a lot of different points of view. So it really is a little bit of both.
Describe to us what a typical classical guitar looks like and how it might differ from what you might see at a
over at Indie Folk Series, what you might see a folk musician performing.
Yeah. You know, at first glance, it's not going to look a lot different than a typical acoustic guitar. The classical guitar, which is often sometimes referred to as the Spanish guitar because it comes out of the Spanish tradition. But, you know, it has the same six strings. It has the same basic body shape. But the probably the biggest difference is the strings are nylon-based. Well, these days often they're carbon fiber. Originally, they used to be gut. But as opposed to a typical acoustic guitar with the Indie Folk Series, which is going to use steel strings. So the sound is not quite as punchy or bright mm-hmm. as those steel strings. It's a lot more mellow, a lot warmer kind of sound. So that's probably the first notice thing that you'll notice. The neck on a classical guitar, the fretboard, tends to be a little bit wider and tends to be more flat than on a typical acoustic guitar. And largely that's just to accommodate the different kind of fingering that you have to do in the left hand. And the strings being further apart makes it a little bit easier with the finger style to isolate the different fingers so that the hand isn't so kind of crunched together. We're talking about millimeters, so you might not notice it on first glance. But but if you've played guitar, you'll notice as soon as you put your fingers on it that you'll feel that difference. So some of the issues are a little bit more practical. Yeah. Is really what the differences are.
Sure. How many instruments do you own?
Last count, it was about 10. Actually, it's funny. I just actually posted a picture on Facebook of all the guitars getting ready to go to school. I said, all the kids are getting ready for their first day of school today. And I had to bring them all back down here for the first day of class.
I love it.
I got to get rid of a few when I moved here because my wife got tired of me carting all these guitars around. But I think most of them... a lot of them are just more sentimental value. One was my grandfather's, one was my father's. So some of them are just more sentimental than anything else.
You come from a guitar playing lineage.
I do, yeah. My dad was my first teacher, actually.
So, really?
Yeah, he was in college in the 60s and was a...
He had to play guitar right then, right?
Yeah, he was an old folky. So, I grew up learning how to play Bob Dylan and Peter and Paul and Mary and things like that. Yeah.
Aw, wow, love it. So as our listeners are hearing this conversation, you've just had the kickoff to the season, which included some of the best guitarists around the city. But you have a whole season of wonderful performers coming in. Let's talk about Anton... Baranov?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He is the winner of last year's Guitar Foundation of America's International Performance Competition. The Guitar Foundation of America, or the GFA, is probably the world's largest organization dedicated to classical guitar. And every year they hold a convention where they bring guitarists from all around the world for workshops and lectures and master classes. And as they do that, they're also hosting this competition, which is probably one of the most prestigious of the classical guitar competitions in the world. Any classical guitarist not currently represented by professional management can compete. So there's quite a few.
So there's not an age limit.
There is, and I'm blanking really on what the age limit is, to tell you the truth. Typically, the winners tend to be in their 20s, early 30s.
Sure.
So part of the prize package for the winner, in addition to a recording contract and a cash prize, is they also get a 50-date concert tour of North America.
Wow.
And which is probably the most important part.
What great exposure.
It really is. And many of these players go on to become really the next leaders in classical guitar. There are several that I saw on this tour when I was a student who are now leading some of the greatest programs in universities throughout the United States, mm-hmm. Performing on major world series. And so it's a great competition. And so the winner is always a fantastic player, and it's one of the highlights of our series, really, as we really look forward to that concert every year.
Yeah. So let's talk about the gentleman who's performing later in October.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Guido Sanchez Portugues. Yeah. He's a guitarist originally from Costa Rica, and he actually completed his doctorate at IU Bloomington, so he's got some Indiana connections here.
Oh, good.
And that's actually how I first came to know him, and he's a fantastic guitarist. In addition to being a performer, he's also a composer, an award-winning composer as well as award-winning guitarist. So
he's
kind of a double hit, yeah, and which you don't get a lot, you know, in classical music today,
no.
The people who really are able to do both. So his compositions are really exciting. They're very fresh and new sounding.
And we'll get to hear some of them when he's here.
I believe he is going to. I haven't seen his program yet, but generally his programs will consist of some of his own works as well as some of the standard literature for the guitar as well.
Excellent.
He currently lives in Champaign, Illinois, and teaches actually at Franklin College, though, here in Indiana. So
he's got a little commute.
Yes, he does. Yeah. but so he's out. He recently moved out there, and he's working in Champaign area as well.
Cool. Cool.
So a fantastic guitar player.
And a reason to get out in the middle of winter, Matt Palmer.
Yeah, we're really excited about Matt's concert. We actually tried to get him about 2 years ago and couldn't do it, just couldn't get the scheduling to work out. But he's been getting amazing reviews everywhere he plays. One person told me that he's winning an audience one standing ovation at a time.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and he released a new CD that's just gotten really great rave reviews from International Guitar Magazine. And so we're actually we've been really looking forward to this concert. And again, yes, a great reason to get out in late January and hopefully it won't be an ice storm.
No ice storms. We're going to have a milder winter. And it will still be winter for your last performer. Tell us about her.
Yeah, we're looking forward to her, too. We actually, Gaëlle Salal is a player from Marseille, France. We've actually tried to get her last year as well, too. And again, just scheduling conflicts, couldn't get it to work out. But she began playing guitar at age 14, which is rather late for a concert artist.
Did she switch from another instrument?
No, actually, it's my understanding that she had a bit of a theater background as well.
Oh, wow.
Which is actually really nice because, you know, the negative stereotypes of classical music with it being that it's stuffy or too conservative and things like that. But none of that applies to Gaëlle. She's really lively on stage, really charming, really has great rapport with the audience and things. And I think some of that probably comes from that background. You know,
yeah.
I saw her perform down at the Guitar Foundation of America convention in Louisville about 2 years ago. A fantastic artist. And if you watch her videos on YouTube, you'll see she's just very engaging with the audience.
And stay tuned because we're going to give you a website where you can go to find out more about each of these concerts.
Sharon Gamble with the Society of the Classical Guitar's John Alvarado. Performances are held at IUPUI's Informatics and Communications Technology Complex at 535 West Michigan Street. You can learn more and view the season schedule at indianaguitar.org. Again, indianaguitar.org.
Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Back in the day, there was a wonderful Celtic band called the Irish Rovers who did this great infectious tune about the orange and the green.
Yes.
And I feel like we need to find an old recording of that and cue it up
Matt
for Sosie our talent.
And find that for us.
That's right.
Yeah,
That's right.
Well, this is the weekend of, in many ways, the orange and the green. And we'll talk about that on that calendar that we call...
What do we do?
Which color do you want to go with?
Gosh, I'll go with orange.
Orange,
but spelled with a J.
O-R-A-N-J-E.
It's
yes.
Orange Weekend. It's mm-hmm. You've never been to Orange, man. It's a happening. It's an art happening. It's a music happening. It's a performance art happening. It's a little bit of a fashion happening.
It is, and
DJing.
It's
happening.
Like an art fair, but inside and with kind of a party going on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's Saturday night at the state fairgrounds,
mm-hmm.
actually, and this is. Can you believe 13th year they've been doing
no,
this?
No, that's impossible.
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Yeah. And so Ryan Hickey is organizing it once again. Over 30 artists, plus, as you said, lots of live music. And there's beverages, and there's fashion, and it is an over 21 event. You know, every year, though, I was talking to someone the other day about the event. And every year people ask me, oh, I feel like I'm too old for Orange.
No, not at all. It's an all-ages event.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, yes, there are hipsters there,
and
there are retirees, and there's everyone in between.
Exactly.
And it's very, very welcoming, and it's a great place to, if you really want a chance to talk with some really cool artists about their
mm-hmm.
work, because the artists set up not just booths, but sort of like each of them have their own Enviro lounges that they create
to
show off their work, and they really want to hang out and chat about their work.
Right, and of course, many of them are happy to sell you some work, but that's not a requirement. So yeah, check out Orange, and I know you've been practicing some toasts for the green part of our leading item here.
That's right. We can't forget the green because it is Irish Fest weekend, 19th annual Indies Irish Fest weekend going on through Sunday, and it is taking place once again at Military Park, and it is an awesome event with great Irish food and dance and music and culture and sheep
shearing, kilted runs,
sheep herding with dogs. That's my favorite part. And the kilted run. Oh, that's good stuff.
What does a real Irishman wear under his kilt?
Well,
you have to go to Irish Fest
to find out. There you go. But if you're looking for a kilt, if for some reason you don't have your own kilt, then you can certainly buy one at Irish Fest. Because they have lots of cool Irish vendors.
I think we just sent
well.
A bunch of listeners to their closets. I used to have a kilt. Do I still
sure.
have it?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Oh, I love Irish Fest. Irish Fest is just a ton of fun.
Indeed.
Always such a great event. And there's other colorful events
what?
Going on.
There yeah. sure are.
What else do you have there, Sharon?
Well, actually, coming up very soon, actually next weekend on and the following weekends, September 20th, 27th, and October. There are ghosts getting
wow.
in there, the
Ooh.
Other kind of spirits. October 4th from 1 to 4 at the Eideljorg. Artist in residence Dawn Dark Mountain, who's from the Oneida people of Wisconsin, she specializes in something called transparent watercolors, which are really luminous and beautiful. In addition to her paintings, she creates linoleum and woodblock prints that are then completed with watercolor. And she's going to do a demonstration and a little talk from 1 to 4 on three Saturdays, starting next Saturday, the 20th, then the 27th, and October 4th at the Eideljorg.
Cool. That yeah. sounds awesome. Hey, there is a new venue for art and music in Carmel, and it is called The Warehouse. It's located at 254 First Avenue Southwest, adjacent to the Monon Trail, as is everything, and in between Carmel's old post office and old fire station. So The Warehouse, very cool performance venue, arts performance venue for all types of artists, and they are doing an event on Saturday, September 13th from 5 to 9, opening their doors for Art and Harmony. It's their first inaugural gallery show, and it's going to be mixed media, and there's going to be all types of local artists. It is free, but you might want to RSVP at liveforthemusic.com. Again, liveforthemusic.com. And amongst the artists that are going to be there, Cindy Wingo, I love her work, and Bruce Dean, and all sorts of paintings and illustrations and photographs and ceramics and all bunch of other stuff. Mosaics, paperwork, jewelry by Clyde Sullivan, glassworks by Lisa Pilo, and all the artists are going to be there as well. And this is pretty
and
cool.
And music, too.
And music, too, yeah. Heather Ramsey Clark, who's a great jazz musician, is one of the co-owners of, mm-hmm. of the place. So that's going to be pretty fun. So yeah, so you can check out their big first event, Art and Harmony, on Saturday, September 13th, 5 to 9, at the Warehouse in Carmel.
Speaking of music, some of the top violinists in the entire world are in our town right now, participating in the Quadrennial International Violin Competition of Indianapolis. And you can go to the rounds and hear them performing and playing against one another, and you can make your plan at violin.org, whether you want to hear solo work or ensemble work, and find out all about how this works. It's a really fascinating event. Only happens every 4 years, but then the violin competition folks provide artistic guidance and career guidance in the other 4 years, and also bring wonderful chamber musicians to town to perform on regular chamber music concerts throughout the 4 year period. Again, find out more at violin.org.
Yeah, there's so many events for that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, there's something going on right now.
Indeed.
Yes. Hey, speaking of violins, the symphony is of course opening their season this weekend on Sunday, September 14th. They're having their big opening night gala, and there are a few tickets available that you could perhaps get for the performance, and that's going to be a whole bunch of fun with Urbanski leading the ISO in a performance of excerpts from Swan Lake, as well as some Beethoven and other great stuff. But you might also want to check out, and the symphony did this last year, and it was a really lovely event, and they're doing it again, a free community day on Saturday, September 13th, so leading up to their big grand opening. And the community day takes place from 2 to 6 p.m. at the Hilbert Circle Theater. Doors will be open. They'll be doing some music, some activities, some prize giveaways, some ticket giveaways, and there'll be a concert featuring ISO Maestro Urbanski at 5 p.m. And that will be very, very cool. And there'll also be a chance to like meet musicians and during meet and greet stuff. And it's going to be a great event for kids and adults as well. You can even pick up a baton and learn how to conduct an orchestra, though I don't think they need anyone to do that right now. But, you know,
you never know. You know, you might be stopped at a red light somewhere and there's just an itinerant orchestra in need of a conductor
it
there
happen.
On the corner.
But yeah, there you go. So free at the Hilbert, the ISO, on Saturday from 2 until 6 p.m. That should be a great day.
If you're hearing us Thursday night and you're a percussionist or just like to learn about music from the inside out, famous rock drummer Kenny Aronoff, who's played with the likes of John Mellencamp, John Fogerty, people not called John, like Smashing Pumpkins, and many more, will be at the Schwartz Center on Butler University's campus this Friday night at 7:30. Admission is free and open to the public without tickets. Schwartzcenter.org for more information on that, S-C-H-R-O-T. Center.org. Kenny Aronoff this Friday night, the 12th.
Cool. Hey, put this on your calendar for a little bit in the future. This is on October 3rd. Heron High School, which if you've heard about Heron High School, you know that they do study the classics as part of their education, and they do some very cool stuff. And they are doing an urban epic. They are doing a reading, an open-air continuous reading of Homer's Iliad.
Wow.
And this is presented in part through the Junior League of Indianapolis. And you can get free tickets for this on Eventbrite if you search for urban epic Iliad or just check out Heron High School. But basically what they're going to do is that it's going to start at 6 p.m. on a Friday and end dramatically around 9 p.m. And they'll be serving Greek cuisine, which we love.
How appropriate.
And the Latin Club will be in costume, and they'll have all sorts of fun things that they'll be doing throughout the time, and they will be reading the Iliad. So it sounds like a really cool thing for high school students to do and worth checking out on October 3rd at 6 o'clock at Heron High School.
That is so smart. Love that. Love that. Civic Theater is opening its season with the acclaimed Broadway musical called Swing. And it's
Swing!
Swing, swing, swing with a... Wait, no, that's Sing, Sing, Sing with a Swing. But that's actually the... If you suddenly got a tune in your head when you heard that lyric, that's the sort of music that you'll be seeing and hearing if you go see the production. And it's very, not surprisingly, very high energy, revolving around classic American swing music. Just infectious, good family fun. Again, that's at Booth Tarkington Civic Theater at the Center for the Performing Arts through Saturday, September 20th.
And last thing, I got just a reminder that Jazz Fest opens this weekend, and it is going on continuously at lots of different locations. Jazz Kitchen, Cabaret at the Columbia Club, Old National Center, Madam Walker Theater, all types of other places around town. And there are concerts every single day and night from now until next Saturday, the 20th. And you can get the full schedule at indiejazzfest.net. Some concerts are free, some concerts are not, but they're all awesome.
If you're thinking, ooh, cooler temperatures, I need to boost my fall and winter wardrobe, put this on your calendar. September 27th, 10 to 5 at the Eideldorg, a Pendleton trunk show. Fabulous Pendleton wool, jackets, sweaters, also accessories for yourself or for gifts. That's coming up at the Eideldorg September 27th from 10 to 5.
Very good. Well, you can also learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org. Again, indiearts.org. That's the Arts Council of Indianapolis's event site. And, of course, we'll be back with more ideas for you on that calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Indiana Repertory Theater is kicking off its new season and is doing it in a very artistic way. Travis DiNicola spoke with the IRT's Janet Allen and with painter Kyle Ragsdale about their partnership, the artwork, the plays that inspired his artwork, and the upcoming season.
Janet, Kyle, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you both here.
Why, thank you, Travis.
It's really fun to
be here.
We're
happy to be here.
Well, I am so delighted you're here, and I'm so delighted about this project. I mean, I love the IRT, and I love the work that you do each and every season, Janet.
Thank you, sir.
And I am a big fan of Kyle Ragsdale.
Me too.
And in full disclosure, I do own, we'll just say a number of them.
Oh, really, I've only got one so far
so,
in my house.
I was so excited to see this when I first heard that you were going to have Kyle do paintings of each of the shows of this IRT season. I thought, what a brilliant idea. How did this come about? I mean, Kyle, I know you love theater.
And I've been a fan of the IRT for a year since I moved here, I think. And I think maybe Emily Holloway had a little bit to do with it.
Emily was a bit of a matchmaker, Travis.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was a little afraid to approach him because he's a god, as far as I'm concerned. And so, yes, we did have some matchmaking in the middle, but we had met, and I knew that Kyle came to the theater, and I said to Emily, you know, I have this crazy idea, and I know that he works for Summer Stock Stage with you, and do you think he'd ever consider doing this? She was like, oh, you've got to talk to him.
Yeah, because I've been dreaming of it for years. Back in Fort Worth, there was somebody that painted every summer for Shakespeare in the Park, and I've always dreamed of something like this. And so when I didn't even know exactly what we were talking about. So when we first met, and I was just kind of like, this, I think it would be great to paint the whole season. I don't know what you think, but. And so.
Well, we didn't know exactly what it was going to be other than a collaboration at first, Travis, and how many paintings there would be as a result of it. We kind of went in blind and had a conversation, Kyle. I said, you want to come down and talk about doing something? He said, sure. We sat down and talked, and he said, I'd love to do something for every play.
It's such a cool idea. How many plays are there through the season?
Nine.
Okay.
Nine fabulous plays. Yeah.
including Two Gentlemen of Verona,
yes,
which
indeed.
Opens September 16th.
Yeah.
And some other pretty fantastic ones like Red. And, of course, the season closes out with On Golden Pond. But in the middle, you've got Velveteen Rabbit and How of the Baskervilles and Christmas Carol as Always and The Giver and Good People and What I Learned in Paris and so on and so on. But, okay, so all of a sudden, you're like, I'm going to do a painting for each play? And to be clear about the paintings are being used in posters and programs.
Yes. And we have made note cards to sell in the gift shop out of them because they're so gorgeous. Mm-hmm. They are art that will be with us throughout the season, but we will also auction them at the radio show.
So,
there's a lot of interplay of this stuff.
Yeah. Yep. So, Kyle.
Program covers, too. They are on.
Oh, program
covers,
of course.
There are program covers. Yeah.
So, this is such a cool project. I'm sure you had to love doing it. But, I'm guessing you had probably not seen every play before.
No. She gave me the scripts.
And
I
read
through all the plays.
Okay.
Well, first
fell in
he
love with all the
said,
plays.
Could I read them? And that was like, music to my ears. Because plays are not easy to read.
Right.
And the fact that he wanted to was like, the love affair is complete. So Kyle read them all. And then we did a charrette.
And that's actually really important. I mean, because you know what? I just assumed, knowing Kyle and knowing and the type of way that you work and how you love to work, that of course you read all the plays. But not every designer would necessarily do that.
Oh, plays are hard. And it takes a certain
And you're certainly
kind of
more
temperament.
Than a designer in this, Kyle. But
right.
Yeah, but as you say, it's a different type of approach than probably when you've worked with a design team or
it's completely different than working with a graphic artist.
Yeah.
Because we did a charrette. We did about maybe 3 hours of three of us from the staff sat down with Kyle to talk about sort of what directions we wanted to go. And he came in saying, I'm thinking that in this one there are these three characters that would be kind of the focal point of it. So he came in with ideas.
But you had to share with Kyle what, your directors already have visions for what the plays are going to look and feel like.
Yep.
And that may be a little bit different from what is in the script.
Indeed.
You know,
so we had to talk
read.
About that, which was fun to say, we're not doing any old Two Gentlemen of Verona. We're doing one that's kind of leveraged up out of 1790.
Okay.
He said, oh, yay. So that was great fun in that charrette to talk about the specifics of what we knew about production. And some of the plays aren't published yet. So
yeah, sure.
That was fun. He was reading stuff in manuscript.
Tell me more, Kyle.
Yeah, it was really great. Just to imagine and then just to start painting. And I would send pictures off my phone and say, what do you think about this? And I loved it. Loved every minute of it. It was really fun. It was fast. We had to read fast and think fast and, you know, paint and repaint and repaint.
We had big deadlines because I was leaving the country. Then Kyle was leaving for a month for a residency. So we were trying to get it done. And also, one of the things that's so great for us is that they're all done at the beginning of the season and we can use them all year long. And we've almost never done that.
Yeah,
we've developed graphics as we've gone along in a season. Mm-hmm. So that was one of the
things. But it provides such a great thematic connection throughout all the plays.
Yeah.
I mean, because you see them and it's like, you know, I mean, you see the paintings all grouped together in reproduction, which I've seen. And it's like, yeah, it's all Kyle. So there's this sense. But, you know, obviously each play is different. And it was fun for me just to look at the paintings and try to match them with the plays. And for the most part, pretty obvious. I mean, I love The Hound of the Baskervilles. I mean, it's just, it's got this.
Well, that's
this
like playing to my strengths. It's like, I know this era.
Well, so. All the historic stuff, that's certainly one of Kyle's real strengths, and all those beautiful paintings that he's made. What do you call that series? The drama. It's not that. That's not it.
Remember.
But like the flying girls in the big dresses. Yeah. I love all that stuff.
So I want to ask you about Red. Because I just would have to imagine that had to be one of the hardest ones to approach. Because the play Red is about Mark Rothko,
right.
and just a fascinating artist. And I love his work, but he was obviously a very sort of difficult, challenged artist in many ways, and that's what this play is about in many ways. And he's got such a signature style that you always know a Mark Rothko when you see it. And here you are incorporating Rothko's work into your own. I mean, that had to be
well. At one point, I
crazy.
I don't know if I texted or emailed. And I said, I had this really little bitty figure in the corner painting the whole painting, and she's like, I think it needs to be way bigger. And I was like,
the figure,
the figure. And I was like, oh, I just think he would hate that there's a figure on this. You know, like he would just
right because I mean,
it would be the most horrible thing in the world to him. And she's like,
the complete
he would
opposite
hate that we
of
were
Rothko.
Doing this play about.
He would hate that there's a play about him.
Well,
too.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
You know, where do you start? It's you just have to say, hey, it's for the good of many things.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, but it is. I think such. I mean, if you're in an artistic pursuit, it's so true. That struggle of wanting to be true to yourself and make good work and, you know, move, you know, the public along and still, I mean, it's I think every artist has those struggles.
Absolutely.
So it's so relevant to today.
Mm-hmm. You know. And no matter what discipline artists are in.
Oh, totally.
Absolutely.
And that's the great part about Red, whether you are somebody who knows anything about Rothko or abstract expressionism or not, that play is about artistic process for a writer, for a composer, for a painter, for a dancer. For anybody who's an amateur photographer, they will understand that struggle to make art and how you pull it up out of yourself is even true with world-renowned artists. Mm-hmm. That's really the message of the play.
So, Kyle, as you're working on this...
Yeah.
Did you have one that was just like, oh, this is so fun to do? Like, that popped up.
Gentleman of Verona, probably. Which is,
really?
I think what
which
we
is
did
great.
First.
It was the first one.
The first one,
did.
And it's what you're opening your season with.
And it seemed to have sprung.
Again, on September 16th.
Thank you, Travis.
You're welcome, Janet.
soon. It seems to have sprung totally full blown out of Kyle's head. And I saw it for the first time on my phone. I wasn't in the office. And I remember just jumping up and down wherever I was. And texting back and saying, this is perfect.
Yeah.
This is exactly what we were intuiting we could accomplish in this.
It was so fun. And I was just in Vermont for a month painting, and I did a bunch of, I'm calling alternative endings, so different paintings of the same thing. We're going to have a show in October, first Friday in October.
He will be at the IRT instead of at the Harrison Center.
So I loved that place so much. I kept painting it and painting it. So
different variations of
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
It must have been on Golden Pond must have been a fun one to work
yes.
with. Especially
and
if you're
I
in
Vermont.
I
remember that from my childhood. Yeah. And it's funny because I don't think I meant to do it, but Emily Holloway's parents are really good friends of mine. And Jilly Mom's really looks like the lady on the...
Every time I run into Jill now, she says, well, you are going to cast me in the play. Right?
It totally looks like her, and I don't think it just came from my subconscious.
Well, what a cool project.
So much fun.
Yeah. Now, just to be clear,
yes,
we're not using Kyle's paintings as backdrops in any of plays or anything like that. The plays are still being interpreted by the directors.
Oh, yes. And,
that's
a really good point, Travis. Yeah. And in fact, a lot was already in design development before we did this, but not everything is.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the designers will, in fact, see Kyle's work before they start working.
Okay.
But what we wanted was a great art-based, not just graphic arts, but art-based messaging of the plays, pictorial of the plays,
mm-hmm.
that would capture them not just in figure but in color and mood. We talked more about mood probably than anything as Kyle was developing them up, was what does the piece need to do to us emotionally to evoke what we want the play to do.
Well, what a great partnership. How fun. How fun for both of you, and how great for the IRT. And, of course, you know, single tickets are on sale now. Season
they
tickets.
They are. The whole season
the
is
whole
on
season.
Sale.
You can collect all of the programs Kyle's art and then get him to sign them for you afterwards.
That's a great idea, Travis.
That would be fun.
Sorry,
Let's do that.
I think so. I think there's right there a great, you know, reason to be a season subscriber.
Absolutely.
Definitely.
Get the whole collection. It's awesome to see you both. Kyle, thank you so much for coming in to Are the Matter today. Janet, always a pleasure.
Travis, thanks. Great to be here. Thank you.
Travis DiNicola with IRT's Janet Allen and painter Kyle Ragsdale. You can get more information about the IRT season at irtlive.com, irtlive.com.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Vaselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll take a look at an art book about the Richmond Group.
I'll get the preview of this year's Art versus Art competition.
And I'll find out about the Architect's Home Tour, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.